Morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, Michael Abram on behalf of Terrell Oliver, the appellant. What I believe to be the main issue in this case is actually 10 Delaware Code 4331. The main issue is determining if the second forensic toxicologist who was declared later was in fact somebody who actually touched the evidence before the testing occurred. Now, historically, chain of custody was something where, as they point out in Melendez-Diaz, that whatever evidence you offer goes towards the weight and you can figure it out. Whereas if the state chooses to miss a couple steps and there's no problems with that, that the defense is free to argue for the weight of that if you're missing some people along the chain. In 1994, Delaware codified what they believed to be important in the chain of custody, being the packaging officer, the seizing officer, and anybody in the chemist's office who actually touches the substance before it's tested.
Is it undisputed that if the second toxicologist actually touched the sample that was being tested, the introduction of the sample into evidence would have been erroneous?
No. The state actually responded where they actually only used part of 4331 to deny it, where they said he didn't actually touch the sealed package and made reference to the vial that the first forensic chemist made.
If he did touch whatever it was that was tested, would that be dispositive of the appeal?
I believe so. But like I said, they used only the first part where it says he touched the outer package, and they ignored the part where it said put on there by the state police.
So in other words, if I turn to my lab tech and say, here, take this vial and stick it in the machine, and don't get the lab tech to sign off, we can't use 4331 to admit the conclusion of the test?
You would need that lab tech there. Delaware's statute is unique as far as I can tell, because in looking at other states, they don't have specific code saying who is essential. And as this court pointed out in McNally 2 years ago, they have to follow the 4332 demand of everybody being in the chain of custody as listed in 4331. Whereas in other states, or as I said in Melendez-Diaz, where if perhaps the state didn't want to introduce these people, saying that, you know, the lab tech isn't that important, they wouldn't have to, it would just go to the weight. But Delaware's unique code makes it so they actually have to have anybody touches it before the testing happens.
And is your argument essentially that touch means handle as opposed to touch?
Yes, it is, because the statute itself says outside of the police packaging. So it's understandable that if it takes five people inside the packaging, you have a degree of reliability, because by the time it gets there, the lab tech who opens it knows the package is still closed, and it's exceptionally unlikely that going through all these police couriers that somebody would have opened this sealed package and switched the sample. However, the reliability is diminished greatly once the package is actually opened in a lab, and at some point, you know, it could get misconstrued with other samples that are similar. Whereas if the bag changes hands, there's still paper written, sentences written on the outside identifying it properly.
But what I'm having some difficulty with is, isn't there a distinction between actually having contact with the alleged illegal substance versus having contact with a vial or a container or something else in which the substance is located?
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because I think, and I'm not a forensic chemist, that the likelihood that if someone were, say, personally touch some kind of illegal substance, they're probably not going to change the chemical makeup of it. So I don't think it's so much that the concern is over actual physical touching of the substance itself, but I think that there's a degree of security in knowing that it's in a sealed bag with a number on it and a name and a case on it. So you're fairly certain, as long as in that bag, it's in the same item. Whereas once it gets out there, this vial looks like any other vial. And specifically in this case, the medical examiner testified it's in a tray with 25 other ones. They're all testing for cocaine on that day, and they're all the same size samples. So any of those 25 vials could look exactly the same.
Well,
but I assume they have identification on them, correct?
I'm not sure.
Well, how would anybody know which was which if there weren't?
I would say it's probably a fair assumption, just from my personal knowledge. I'm not sure. The medical examiner who testified in this case stated that he put it in a certain spot in the rack. But the concern on the defense's part would be, what if another chemist came in there and moved things around? Or what if the person who actually ran the machine
So you're saying that the evidence in this case is that there was a substance that needed to be tested. It was put in some sort of a vial. It was never labeled. And that vial was then put in a particular location on a rack with 19 other similar substances. Is that what the record is?
I'm saying that I don't recall whether he said it was labeled or not. I would agree with Your Honor that it probably had some kind of identification on it. But that after that point, it was placed in a rack with, I believe he said, up to 25 other samples where they all, we got into specifically that they would do an entire run where they were believed that cocaine would be the substance that they were finding at that point. He said that there's other times where they're unsure what the substance may be, and they might run differently.
Suppose the facts were that, as you laid out, except that the first toxicologist was there the whole time to physically observe the second toxicologist taking the vial out of the sealed package, putting it in a specific location, and then later testing the vial and putting it back in that specific location. During that whole time, there was someone else there, the testifying witness, to observe that there was no interruption of the chain of custody.
I think that would probably, although not in direct harmony with the statute, I think to say that wouldn't be reasonable would be kind of form over substance. I think Your Honor is correct that as long as that person saw it the entire way before the testing, that it would be acceptable, whether somebody else was the one who actually put it in the machine, as long as they were standing right there to observe it.
Help me understand your argument under the statute. Is it your position that 4331 raises the bar and there has to be strict compliance with 4331 for any evidence, drug evidence, to be admitted? Or is 4331 an alternative procedure that was intended to basically facilitate like an affidavit in practice as an alternative to the way things were introduced before that statute was enacted? So is 4331 has to be strictly complied with for evidence to be introduced?
I believe so.
But then why does it have subsection D, which says nothing in this section precludes the right of any party to introduce any evidence supporting or contradicting the evidence contained in the presumption raised by the statement?
I think you could use that for two arguments. You could say that perhaps the couriers in between were maybe not as good as they should be if some evidence came to light that it was that way, or that in fact the chemist testifying on the stand, although present, may have memory lapses or can't make a specific recollection on this. And you could perhaps argue that, you know, just because he's saying this is his perhaps common practice, because it's unlikely he remembers every single drug that he tests, that this is common practice, but you've got to believe that in this case he did the right job. So I think it just doesn't take away the historic arguments you'd always have in chain of custody, but I think it places a specific burden on the state where the legislature decided this is the parts that we really care about. We really care about the guy who gets it, the guy who puts it in the bag, and the people who take it out and test it.
What's your understanding of the purpose of the statute? Was the purpose of the statute to facilitate the admission of the evidence without having
the ME's office staff driving up and down the state, or was it intended to make it harder to introduce the evidence?
No, I believe the intention, as been my experience in a lot of laws that come out, the intention was to make life easier for the state, because as the process comes out, typically an officer will take the evidence back. If we're talking about state police, we'll say take it back to their troop. Somebody would collect it from that troop and move it to a more centralized location. Another person from the ME's office would then get this and take this back to the ME's office. So absent this, you'd have to have the officer, perhaps the evidence technician at one state police troop, the person who moved it to another state police troop, and then the person who transported. Three people who are just going to testify that they had a closed, sealed bag. So I think the intention of the statute was to say, those people aren't really necessary. You know, nothing's going to happen with this bag while it's closed, but these are the other people that we really think are important. So I think by taking part of the stress away from the less important people, they put it more on the more important people.
Well, let's combine what you just said with the Sixth Amendment. You talk about the Melendez-Diaz case, and you cite that in your brief. And that's all about the right of confrontation. The statute seems to indicate who you're entitled to confront. And the statute uses the word touch, and the implication is the person did something. And now, in this particular case, we have a second toxicologist. You know, we don't have a... And the name toxicologist to me indicates there's training or something. And we have testimony from the person who actually appeared on behalf of the state that it was important that the second toxicologist knew what they were doing. As I read the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, it said if someone in the chain could have committed an error that would skew the results, you're entitled to cross-examine the person who might have committed the error. Now, in this particular case, you're saying all the people who touched the envelope really couldn't have committed an error, and that makes sense. But once it's out of the envelope, you have a right to cross-examine anyone who could have contributed to an erroneous result. And my question is, in reading the briefs, on the one hand, we have the drug put in a vial that's put in a machine. On the other hand, it looks like the person who does that really needs to know what they're doing because they couldn't make a mistake. Why do we need two experts, two toxicologists? What was this second person doing that would entitle you to cross-examination?
I think as you stated, the second person, I think Justice Ginsburg states kind of in Bullcoming that the person who operates the machine, they're the gas chromatograph, mass spectrometer. Every step along the way, there's the possibility for error. And I think the actual forensic chemist who testified in this case stated that there were a couple different ways that the machine could be run, and it was actually up to that chemist to determine which way was the best way to do it. I think it was kind of based on, you know, if you were more sure of what the substance was to start or less sure, that perhaps it would take 8 minutes or perhaps it would take 12 minutes because it was a more comprehensive run. And that discretion is totally up to the second chemist. So aside from the more benign things of did he put the right vial in the right spot, did he properly calibrate the machine that day, but what did he actually do?
Well, here's the testimony of Dr. Bawa, who testified. He's describing the second chemist. He says, the chemist has to be very efficient, shouldn't be doing anything else. He has to be a good chemist. So when I look at the data, we look at the sheet and everything identical. So it appears that the chemist who actually testified said that the other chemist really had a role to play.
I would agree completely.
So why did the court rule the other way? I understand you're in the middle of trial. All of a sudden, everyone's surprised that there's a second chemist involved. But to the extent one chemist gets to get cross-examined, my question is, if you need two chemists, why don't you get to cross-examine both?
Because I would respectfully submit that the lower court erred. I think Judge Stokes asked some questions of the chemist who was up there, and he relayed some information about the procedures in place in that court. And I believe Judge Stokes took it that because these other procedures were in place and that he he saw nothing on its face that was incorrect, that it was acceptable, which I think flies in the face of the Confrontation Clause, that there's no way to effectively cross-examine a set of regulations or procedures. And what I think especially telling in this case is that when I asked the medical examiner, you know, do you have personal knowledge of this case, which, as you know, there's certain examples that Justice Sotomayor says, you know, may pull you in, that they have not decided yet. He said, no. He says, I do about 50, 60 cases a week. I have no personal recollection of how this case went down whatsoever. So it's not fair to assume that him talking about just the protocols, he was talking about what occurred on this date, because he stated directly, I was not there. I do not recall what this guy did. And in this, I believe his initial opening of the package was on the 14th of the month, and he ended up reviewing his notes on the 20th and signing off before they went out to be formally typed up. So we have a six-day interim period. It's understandable that he would have no recollection of what happened at this point. And the simple remedy for this issue to never come up again would be for the forensic chemist who gets this, when he comes in, to test it himself. He's testified that he's fully capable of doing this. Obviously, if the machine gets run when it gets full, there's no, you know, this has got to be done in the next 30 seconds or 30 minutes, and we only have one machine. There's absolutely no reason why that person couldn't just run it themselves.
So in this case, your position then is that the state used two chemists. They could have just as easily used one. But in your particular case, the fact that you had a right consistent with the statute to have the chemist there, you also had a right under the Constitution to confront both chemists if the state decided to use two chemists.
Yes, and I would disagree with the state's position that the second chemist was just a button pusher, which they put in their brief. Clearly, as you stated, his requirements as a forensic chemist and the testimony of the other forensic chemist that says this man has to do everything correctly or his results will be skewed or this forensic chemist would not be able to properly analyze the results that came out with him doing his job wrong shows that he's not a button pusher.
Does he have to be a chemist to run this machine?
According to their protocols, from what we got on direct testimony in this matter, yes.
So the error that you're concerned with, or at least what I understood from the briefs, and that would require the testimony of the second toxicologist, is that the wrong sample may have ended up getting tested or reported on.
Well, it's that. It could be the wrong sample, or the person who was running the machine could have done it improperly. And the only way to...
I understand that those are both possibilities, but I did not sense that the second potential error was involved here, that you were claiming that. Do I read your brief correctly or not?
Probably. Writing is not one of my strongest suits. I guess that's why I'm a trial lawyer more. But in coming up with maybe not stated as specifically as it should have been, but when bringing up Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming, said a lot of Bullcoming is saying that
So you didn't flag that risk in your brief, but you're flagging it now.
As I've been rereading this over and over again, I couldn't give you the best answer in the world whether or not I flagged it appropriately or not. Your Honor could be very, very correct that I did not.
But your point was you had a right to cross-examine this second chemist about anything that would be relevant at the time of the cross-examination, and you were completely denied the right of cross-examination.
And there was no way I could have known, because as the second argument states, the state failed to disclose this, even though I properly requested to know who their experts were and to have the report that they denied, that they didn't give me. So there was no way for me to adequately prepare to say this person should be here. It came out after the actual evidence was introduced. So I think the state argued some points that I didn't, you know, raise the objection at the proper time, where it would have actually been impossible for me to raise it before it was introduced, because the state withheld the information that I was properly entitled to, as the court ruled, to be able to even make that objection at that point. I didn't know. They kept me in the dark.
You've used up about half the time you wanted to save. Do you want to save the remaining minute, 5.5 minutes?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sean Lugg on behalf of the state of Delaware. There are, I believe, as has been argued, three separate and distinct issues before the court today. There's a chain of custody issue, there's a Sixth Amendment issue, and finally, as was mentioned at the conclusion of counsel's argument, there is a Rule 16 discovery issue. As to the chain of custody, the question is whether there was sufficient evidence allowing the jury to conclude that the cocaine found associated with Mr. Oliver was, and that was subsequently tested, was in fact the cocaine that was tested, and whether or not that evidence was properly authenticated under Rule 901 using the various procedures that are set forth in 4331, but with the backdrop of this court's long history of cases dealing with chain of custody.
Well, do you agree that under the statute, the chemist who testified was required to testify?
Absolutely.
All right, so tell us why the second chemist wasn't required to testify.
Well, there are a few reasons. First of all, the chemist that testified to great lengths over the course of 2 days, very brief trial, but probably the most testimony from Mr. Bajwa. And Mr. Bajwa, in fact, testified as to exactly what he did. There was a question that was posed during my colleague's argument as to whether or not these samples were labeled. And the record is clear on that point.
I don't want to use up all your time with a question that's unclear. The record reflects there was a second chemist involved, that the second chemist had expertise, and there's an indication that a chemist needs to run the machine. My question for you is not what the chemist who testified did, but if someone ran the machine, why, and they had to be a chemist, why weren't they required to testify?
Well,
first under the statute, then we'll talk about the Supreme Court cases.
Well, as to chain of custody first, under the statute, I believe Justice Ridgely pointed out the final portion of the statute, which allows chain of custody to be established both through the statute but through other means. And this court's decision in Denby went through post the enactment of the statute and was clear that this court never expected every witness in the chain to testify, and that, frankly, the state must prove or be able to establish that there is not a probability of tampering.
Right,
and that was established in this case.
I accept that answer under the statute in the interest of not using up all of your time.
Thank you.
So my second question is, if you have a right to confront the first chemist under the Constitution, why don't you have a right to confront the second chemist?
Well, and that brings us to, shifts us into the Sixth Amendment forum, I believe, and there was a reference to Justice Sotomayor's concurrence in Bolkoming, and I think it squarely brings us to that, where Justice Sotomayor spent a great amount of time explaining the very limited reach of the Bolkoming decision. Clearly, we're not in a Bolkoming scenario where a second chemist simply picked up a file and testified to what the other chemist did, but rather what Mr. Bajwa did is offer his expert opinion. One of the exceptions that Justice Sotomayor indicated the Supreme Court was not holding in Bolkoming. What Mr. Bajwa did, and actually twofold, he was a participant in the testing process itself and offered his expert opinion. Now, with respect to the question as to whether or not a chemist is required to participate in this process here in the state of Delaware, the record on that point is unclear. What the record did establish is that a chemist did participate in this particular case. And in appellant's appendix, there was the reference that Your Honor, the citation that Your Honor read in open court today, but that continues, and that quote continued to say that what Mr. Bajwa does is he looks at the data, looks at the sheet, and everything identical. And of course, there was the language barrier here as well, so some of the record is somewhat skewed by that. Then we have to let him know to rerun these samples. It has to be a specific place, spot, and everything. The way I do it, if it's not, they have to rerun them. And he said, quote, I label the file, I write down on the sheet, which is all the sequence. So clearly in this case, what was happening was Mr. Bajwa was taking that, opening the sample, and we have no argument, I believe, before the court today that anything was...
What you just said raises the question I mentioned earlier. The United States Supreme Court said if a person involved in the analysis could commit an error, you're entitled to cross-examine them. And what you just indicated suggests that the second chemist had to do something right, and Mr. Bajwa was supervising it, and Mr. Bajwa testified, and that's fine. But what the defense is arguing is if the second chemist could have done something wrong, then they were really doing something, and that could lead to an error, whether it did or not, and you're entitled to cross-examine someone who participates in the process that may make a dispositive error.
Well, and on that point, I don't think the Supreme Court of the United States was precisely clear on that, and that's precisely why Justice Sotomayor has spent so much time explaining what the court was not ruling on. Mr. Bajwa offered his expert opinion, to be sure, and his expert opinion included reliance on at least this chemist doing something, and that was disclosed. Now, to be sure, and we can deal with the Rule 16 portion as well, this was something lately discovered in the case, and the court accommodated the defense by allowing an opportunity to review and time to do that. So in this case, the question is whether the state complied with the Sixth Amendment by presenting Mr. Bajwa as the witness to establish and offer his opinion to the court, which is distinguishable from the issues in Volkoming, Melendez-Diaz, and Crawford. Whether or not defense sought to question that witness about what they did is something that the defense could have and did have the opportunity to do.
But let's talk about that. If you're right on the chain of custody and you're right on the Sixth Amendment, the defense is saying, well, the Rule 16 violation really wasn't a remedy because of the amount of time. I understand there was a recess and there's an exchange in the record about what you can do overnight. But if you have no break in the chain of custody and there's no Sixth Amendment violation, it really seems to be a concern that you'd find this out in the heat of trial and have 24 hours to decide what you want to do. If, in fact, the discovery had been complied with in a timely way, the defense could have decided whether it wanted an expert. The defense could have accepted your argument. There was no right to confrontation, but subpoenaed the second chemist anyway. Why isn't the discovery issue reversible error, that notwithstanding you're prevailing on the first two issues, that the remedy was simply inadequate?
Well, I believe the remedy was adequate, to be sure, and in this case, a few things happened. First of all, and I agree with counsel, that had this happened earlier, we might not be standing before the court today, or at least in this position, but he did have the opportunity to flesh out the record more with respect to the actions of Mr. Bajwa, and in fact, Mr. Bajwa was brought back the second day. So the remedy afforded the defense in this case wasn't simply recessing overnight and picking back up the next day, but rather there was additional testimony from Mr. Bajwa that was allowed to be received. And the second part, and why this should not be a reversible error, is I would refer to this court's decision in the case of Taylor, where certain records were identified on the eve of trial and were provided. And a very, very similar...
Did we condone that? Or did we simply say it wasn't reversible error?
The latter.
And so, as you know, when we write these opinions, you know, we're anticipating that they're going to be read and followed. How many cases are we going to decide where there's a discovery violation that comes up during trial, and we're always asked to do a harmless error analysis? At some point in time, when is discovery going to be provided in a timely way, on a regular basis?
Well, and my hope and expectation is that it is. And so I look at these cases and addressing Your Honor's concerns, hope that they are the exceptions rather than the rule. And, of course, this Court's decisions are reviewed and discussed and acted upon. But to the point as far as the error in this case and how the Court should consider it, the defense was afforded the opportunity to review. And why I draw an analogy to the Taylor case is that there was time allowed. Almost identical solution to the problem in Taylor's was offered here. Take the evening, review it. And much like what happened in Taylor happened here, there was a series of hypotheticals, what could be done or what I could have done had I known, but there was no subsequent follow-up request for more time. And clearly that is what, I at least in the reading of Taylor, what this court looked at. There was no follow-up request. And so looking at the record, the 15th of February last year, parties appeared and simply picked up where they were, and there was no further complaint made by the defense that he needed more time, except when dealing with the issues and saying, well, I could have. And so when that request wasn't made, I believe we are in the harmless error status despite the fact, and I will, as I stand before this court, recognize that these are things that, and as my colleague did at trial, should have been provided. So as to that discovery issue, I believe that Taylor speaks to that issue, and we ask the court to follow that.
Let me make sure I understand you. Is it your position or the state's position that if there is a last-minute discovery, a last-minute discovery violation, the burden is on the defense to make any additional requests that it needs or feels that it needs, such as I want a continuance so that I can depose the other chemist or subpoena the other chemist or even review these notes more thoroughly, that if the defense doesn't ask for anything more than what the court had already given, which was 10 hours or whatever, then that means it was not a reversible error?
Well, it seems to be what can be taken from the Taylor decision, and it's not necessarily a burden shifting, but rather an acceptance of the trial court's exercise of discretion. In this case, Judge Stokes looked at what had happened, looked at what was before it, and proposed with the recommendation of the state, a solution to the issue with nothing else added. And so, yes, if that occurs, and there is no alternative proposed by defense, then we're left with a record indicating defense was at least satisfied with that solution to the issue. And as Judge Stokes spent some time going through the potential remedies under Rule 16, that's what the court found within its discretion was the appropriate remedy for that particular case.
What is the status of Williams versus Illinois? Isn't the issue in Williams directly on point to this case?
The status is it's been argued. It was argued in December, and we're awaiting a decision from the United States Supreme Court. The issue in the case is slightly different. That case squarely involves the exception noted by Justice Sotomayor that an expert may rely on, or at least the position posed, that an expert may rely on something they're wholly uninvolved in. And that is, there was a DNA test that was performed by someone not near the courthouse. And the person who testified relied on that in reaching a conclusion. So I think there are some similarities to be drawn, but I believe it's distinguishable. And I believe that this court could decide this case without looking at Williams. As I noted, there was an expert who testified, but it was an expert who was involved in the process here. The expert, in fact, had direct involvement with the second person who, as was noted by Mr. Boswa, pushed the button to complete the testing.
You mentioned that, and we go back to pushing the button as if there was no training, but the record shows someone needed training. It was suggested when your colleague was arguing that Mr. Boswa could have done everything, but decided to involve a second person. So my first question is that correct? And my second question is, if the state decides to involve two chemists, two people with expertise, why don't you get to cross-examine them both?
Well, and that really puts us into the Sixth Amendment question and those exceptions noted by Justice Sotomayor. It is a process that's done. It's dictated by volume, to be sure. And
well,
that's
go to my first question. Could Mr. Boswa have done everything himself?
Could he have? Yes.
All right. So it was an internal decision that he wouldn't be the sole person doing this series of tests, but it was an internal decision to get two chemists involved. So my second question is, did you need a chemist to do it, or could I have done it? You have done it. I mean, you and I can push the button. We have no expertise. Or did you need a chemist?
Well, and that's where I think the record falls short, because the record in this case, and to be sure, was developed in the context of a chain of custody.
Mr. Boswa says he has to be a good chemist. That was his testimony.
Correct. And so to answer your question, I don't believe that a chemist is required to do this. And in some instances, I believe lab techs or some with less than a degree that this particular person had can perform this task. What Mr. Boswa was explaining to the court in this instance was there needs to be an expectation that the person is pressing the button correctly, or at least putting the equipment and the tubes, the vials, into the machine correctly to generate the test results. But that is also why Mr. Boswa continued on to explain that when he gets those results back, those chromatograms, He reviews them to make sure that they are in fact done correctly.
Well, so let me follow up on Justice Holland's question. And let's, for purposes of this, put aside the confrontation issue and the discovery issue. The concern here is that the second chemist may have made some error in the course of testing. A competent defense counsel would want to cross-examine to uncover, hopefully, whether or not that error took place. And so I suppose the questioning of the only chemist who is in the courtroom to testify would be, how can you tell us that chemist number two didn't make an error in performing his tests?
Well, I believe he did answer that question. And that was
how?
In the continuation of the description of the chemist, that he looks at the data, he looks at the sheet, and makes sure everything's identical. And then determines whether or not there's a need to rerun the samples.
Forget chain of custody. We're talking about some error that might have taken place during the course of the testing. Isn't it correct that the only thing that chemist number one can talk about is the procedure that's normally followed? But if he's asked whether that procedure was followed in this case, he wouldn't be able to testify about that of his own knowledge, would he?
Well, what he can, and I believe what he did testify to.
Would he?
Yes, in this case, and he did this.
How could he know that chemist number two, who did the test that was not observed by chemist number one, didn't make a mistake?
Well, and that's why there's the secondary system that we've heard about, and that is the documenting that in fact, Mr. Bajwa documented by hand the placement of the vials within the rack.
If you're talking about chain of custody, I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about some other error, technical error, that may have been made in the course of the testing.
Well, I think with all respect, I'm not attempting to not answer your question, but I think that there is some chain of custody involved in the understanding of how he knows that it's done correctly. And so he knows it's correct because the data that is received from that machine, the raw data, the number four from Justice Sotomayor's exclusion from Bulkaming, is returned and is associated with the numbers that he doesn't
give a hand. The data may be associated with that vial. I'll assume that.
Okay.
The question is, how do you know that the data is any good?
Well, and that's the subjective.
Without being able to cross-examine the chemist who developed the data.
Well, and that's where, and I believe Bulkaming noted this in footnote one or two, talking about the subjective component of the analysis, that the subjective assessment of this case was done by Mr. Bajwa. He is the one who interpreted the data. That person who carried it away and brought it back simply, and that gets us back to the button pushing. So the data that was generated by the GCMS machine and was a stack of papers that was returned with the vials, the chain of custody part, to Mr. Bajwa at his bench. As a bench chemist, he then reviewed that data.
Yes, but how could he know whether the data was accurately generated by the machine?
Well,
suppose there was some calibration error. How would chemist number one, Mr. Boswell, be able to assure a court and a jury that that is not an issue without there being some testimony in some form?
Well,
by
and that's
chemist number two.
And I think in this history of Sixth Amendment cases over the past decade, that's precisely what was mentioned in footnote one to Melendez-Diaz. That you don't need every single person. And in fact, they mentioned a person testifying to the operation of the machine. Mr. Bajwa testified to the testing process and what his opinion was. And he was the witness that was offered and subjected to cross-examination.
Yes, I understand that.
He also reviewed the work of the second chemist, though, and found no problem. Is that right?
Well, and that he did as far as the work being the materials generated from the machine. And that's where, in response to your earlier question as far as distinguishing it from Williams, that first chemist, and this is Mr. Bajwa's testimony, he said he only run the samples. He doesn't do any testing, anything. What he does, we prepare the sample, we extract everything, then record it, close it, give it to him. He puts it in there, starts the sequence, and once it's done, he collects the data and gives it to us. And so where it is in Williams, there was a separate DNA analyst who actually offered an opinion that the DNA that was taken from a victim was associated with a particular profile. Here, the second person involved in the process did nothing more but collect that data, the data that St. Williams could have enabled a person to do that, but never offered their opinion and reviewed it to say that, in fact, the drugs that were in spot, say, 24, were cocaine in this case. And that's where I think it's distinguishable.
At least implicit that the second chemist operated the machine correctly and did what was supposed to be done and produced an accurate reading from the machine?
I believe it is, and I believe that that's where, you know, there's a line, and to be sure, you referenced should we wait and should Williams guide us on this? There's a line somewhere where the Sixth Amendment is drawn, and the Supreme Court has clearly said they're not going to draw it at the point where it includes everyone that did anything, and that's why they include the footnote in Melendez-Diaz, and I believe it's also why Justice Sotomayor went to the extent of explaining what it did not rule on.
Well, doesn't... You mentioned the current line's blurry, but it's blurred by the statement that if you're involved in the analysis and you could commit an error that affects the result, then the defendant's entitled to confrontation. And isn't the whole debate, what does that really mean?
Well, yes and no. Yes, there may be a right in some circumstances, but here, the witness who was called and the witness who testified and the witness who testified to the fact that was the accuser, so to speak, against Mr. Oliver was Mr. Bajwa. And that was the witness who was called. And so what the Supreme Court has commented on is there may be other witnesses who can be called, but the state elected to call this witness, subject him to cross and whatever other issues might be there, but the Sixth Amendment was complied with here.
Okay. Maybe all of us, or at least I'm grappling with what the machine was doing and what errors could have been made. Now, we already heard about, well, somebody could have taken the wrong vial either when putting it in the machine or taking it out of the machine. That seems to be taken care of because they were labeled. But do we have a record that shows what could have gone wrong? Could the machine have, if it ran too long or too short a time, would that affect the results? If there was, a power failure in the middle of it, so the machine actually ran twice instead of once, would that affect the results? Do we have any understanding of what errors or inconsistencies that process could have generated?
In the state's answering brief at the appendix at B76, that is where the best description of what the machine does was offered. And Mr. Bajwa went through the process, the testing process that occurred. And he noted, and this brings us back to the appellant's appendix as far as his review, the things that Your Honor has mentioned that could have been problematic are things that Mr. Bajwa testified would be seen and picked up upon when that chromatogram, the chromatograms are received from the machine. It's designed to provide that data. And so he could see that, and that's why his subjective interpretation is so, so important and why he is the witness that needs to be present in the court to testify
okay,
for confrontation purposes.
You're saying that the record will establish that when Dr. Bajwa got back the data, he was able to determine that there had been no error in the process with the machine, because if there had been an error, whatever readout he got to look at would have been different.
And he indicated that if there's a problem, that he would then place it for a rerun. That's
no, but, so what I'm saying is that he is able to determine after the fact that the process ran correctly by looking at the results?
That's correct.
That's the record.
I don't believe the record is crystal clear on that point, to be sure. But he described the process, he further described his review, and he described that if he has concerns with his review of that, that he would submit it for retesting. Now, the question wasn't posed, and he did not say an answer precisely to Your Honor's question, unfortunately, but the record does establish that there is a review of that material, and that he was satisfied with his review, and that he was thoroughly cross-examined on that. And as a final point on all of this, both as to the Rule 16 issue as well as the Sixth Amendment issue, the court went to some lengths to actually include a special jury instruction on these very issues to ensure that the fact finder in this case considered all the various issues. This is following Mr. Bajwa being subjected to extensive cross-examination, that in fact the result wasn't simply just that, and the court should consider all of these various arguments and elements around its consideration of the evidence.
If I might, I would like to back up to the chain of custody question. Does the state rely exclusively upon compliance with 4331, or is there something else that we need to consider besides 4331?
Well, I think this court's decision in Denby, coupled with 4331, answers the question on chain of custody, where 4331 is a method, and as Justice Ridgely noted, it is not the only method of establishing chain of custody. And so in this case, as the court explained in Denby, there was an elimination of the potential of tampering or mishandling in the case, and the jury could have, and with the instruction of the court, I believe did conclude appropriately that, in fact, the evidence was reasonably likely to be the evidence that was secured from Mr. Oliver at the time of his arrest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May I?
Yes.
In response to the last point that was just raised in Denby, I think Denby, they actually complied with 4331. There was just some confusion about which officer handed it to which person, but every officer was actually available, so they did comply with the statute, where in this case they did not actually comply with the statute, so I don't believe that Denby is dispositive.
Why should we be concerned about the discovery violation if you didn't, or defense counsel didn't, ask for anything more than what the court offered, which was the overnight time to review?
I believe I asked for more than that, but the court shut me down. And sometimes when we look at the record, it's not as clear. Judge Doakes can be particularly intimidating at some points, and when he makes his rulings, you take it and you move forward.
But specifically, you didn't at any point say, I need somebody to help me interpret all of this, and therefore I need to get my own expert, or alternatively, I need to subpoena the second chemist because this looks significant to me. No such requests were ever made, right?
Incorrect. I did state that I was not a forensic chemist and that I did not have the ability to review these notes by myself, and that giving me overnight would not be an appropriate remedy.
Do you have a record cite for that?
I believe it might have been in my answering brief.
All right, we can find it.
Did you state what remedy you wanted?
I can't recall if I asked for a mistrial at that point, if I just asked that the evidence not be admitted. I don't believe I asked for a mistrial, so if my recollection is correct, that I probably asked that the evidence not be admitted at that point. Although,
would the record show what you asked for?
The record would, and if I didn't, then I didn't. But it actually comes up at a point where it's already been admitted before I'd even found out about this, so I couldn't properly raise this issue before it was introduced the first time, because I had no knowledge that the issue exists before it was admitted. So we would have been undoing it at that point. As far as the other question about what may happen with regarding the gas chromatograph, in Bullcoming, there's quite a lengthy footnote that notes the several steps are involved in the gas chromatograph process, and human error can occur at each step. They note, in order to perform quantitative analysis satisfactorily and support the results under rigorous examination court, the analyst must be aware of and adhere to good analytical practices. Errors that can occur in any step can invalidate the best chromatographic analysis, so attention must be paid in all steps. So just right there, even if Mr. Bajwa is reviewing these properly, there could have been a step that happened in between that he couldn't have seen. They further note that there was a case where lots of results were thrown out, and the analyst error, a supervisor said, was fairly complex, which would not have led to, we can assume, a case like this where Mr. Bajwa wouldn't be able to pick up on it because the error was so complex by just looking at this.
Well, but doesn't the record indicate that when Dr. Bajwa reviewed the data, he was able to determine that there had been no mistakes made in the process of running the test?
He's not able to fully comprehend if there were any mistakes made. It's just not possible. One of the examples cited in the footnote.
Well, why do you say that? You know, if somebody runs a test and it comes back yellow and it's supposed to have various shades of blue in it, then I can tell that something went wrong with that test. I'm just throwing that out as an example. Arguably, you can also tell the opposite, which is that if the data comes back and it's in a proper form and within certain ranges or whatever it may be, that the person looking at the data can tell from the data itself that the test was properly run.
In Bullcoming, in like I said, in the long footnote, they cite an example of if the person running the machine put too much gas in the vial when it ran.
That's another case. We're talking about the facts of record in this case.
I
thought that Dr. Bajwa testified that he was able to determine by reviewing the data that the testing had been done accurately.
And I guess the reason I'm trying to use that example is the data that he gets would not be able to show whether the machine would have, say, put too much of a sample in at one point, so he wouldn't be able to verify.
Where's the record on that?
At that point, I did not have an expert because I did not suspect that this issue would be coming up, and I was not able to make a record. If discovery would have been properly done, perhaps I could have made the record, but because discovery was improperly done, I did not know that this would be an issue, and it was impossible for me to make a record. So the best I have is a Supreme Court decision stating that these are some of the problems that can come up.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.